in a press conference, which was held about 3 days after the most recent war began in the Middle East. The first question that I was asked surprised me and revealed in its own way so many of the basic misconceptions which are popularly held about that troubled part of the world. The reporter said, "Rabbi, isn't it true that in the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis, God promises Abraham and his descendants all the land from the river of the Nile, the river of Egypt, to the Euphrates? Do you think that the Israeli government will be satisfied this time when they reach those boundaries?" Now, I forget generally that there are Christians who read the Bible in a literal way, with a kind of fundamentalistic belief which is so foreign to our own way of understanding Scripture. I'm often nonplussed when biblical prophecies are thrown up at me as if they are still part of the current operative theology of Jewish life. I hasten to reassure this biblically read reporter, itself an interesting combination of talents and profession, that I doubted that the foreign ministry in Jerusalem was overly concerned about the letter of the biblical rule, that I was quite sure that whatever the lines that would end up after this war would be those where the armies would cease to move and to attack and to counterattack. And I tried to remind him that the theme of Israeli expansionism, which underlay his question, underlay the theology of his question, is a theme which would never have arisen in the popular consciousness if there hadn't been the original theme of Arab exterminationism, the Arab determination to erase, to blot out the Jewish state. If the Arabs claim now that they must retake from Israel their own land, let them remember that Israel took their own land in wars they initiated in order to take Jewish land. And I tried to tell this reporter that I was quite convinced that Israel would be today that very strangely configured, partitioned state, Jewish state, which was envisaged by the United Nations Partition Commission of 1947, if the Arab states had simply let Israel alone. That Israel had made, the Yishuv had made no move to expand beyond the United Nations determined borders, had only responded to the attack of Transjordan and Iraq and of Syria and of Egypt in 1947 and 1948, and that it was always the mobilization of Arab forces, mobilization of Arab forces determined to erase Israel, which had led to the various battles in the Middle East, which had gradually led to the expansion of Israel administrative power in that part of the world. And I think it's important for us to keep this simple truth in mind. It is not that we have displaced Palestinians. Originally, the decision of the world body was to have a Palestinian state and a Jewish state, and no one was to move, uproot any other group. The wars in the Middle East have taken place because one side, the Arab side, has been determined from the very beginning to uproot the Jewish side, the Israelis. And that is the cause of the bloodshed and the violence, and the cruelty, and the uncertainty, the turmoil, which so disturbs us and so disturbs the world. And I was also nonplussed by this question because of the assumptions which underlay it. 3 days before, on Yom Kippur, Syria and Egypt had attacked Israel. And they had put into the field an armed force larger in firepower, number of tanks, than the firepower and the number of tanks which Hitler had marshaled to attack Russia during the Second World War. And those first 3 days of battle had not been easy days for Israel. Israel had been only partially mobilized, and there had been retreat in the Golan, and there had been the successful attack of the Egyptians across the canal. And yet here was an American reporter who assumed that Israel would have a quick and sweeping victory, and Israel would be able to determine, to dictate, if you would, the terms of the peace. Here was the myth of Israeli invincibility, which has, I am afraid, underlying so much of the thought of the United States and even of Israel in these past years. Unfortunately, analysts and generals have a way of planning the last war. They assume that they're planning for the next war, but they're thinking in terms of the last war. I've often stood in this pulpit and warned against that policy which was so popular among well-intentioned men in and out of Washington, which was called even-handedness. Even-handedness meant that when the Soviets supplied Egypt or Iraq or Syria with a new family of sophisticated missiles or a new model of a more powerful tank, or a new model of a more sophisticated airplane which could fly higher or farther or faster, it was not necessary to supply Israel always with a countervailing, a balancing piece of armament. Why? Because obviously the Israelis knew what to do with their armor and the Egyptians did not. Israel was invincible, Egypt was vincible. Israel soldiers were capable, the Egyptian, Syrian, Iraqi soldiers were supposedly incapable. Why? Because in 1956 and in 1967 there had been great and swift victories. What the world forgot is that there's no relationship between the number of PhDs in an army and the effectiveness of that army. Some of the greatest armies of the world have been comprised of illiterate barbarian hordes. They defeated the Roman Empire. And some of the great armies of the world, the army of Napoleon, was swept up from the sewers and the gutters of the slums of the capitals of Europe. The armies of the world have been impressed, conscripted, and impounded from the dregs of mankind, and they have fought well. Provide an army with good equipment. Train an army carefully in the use of that equipment, which is relatively simple. Prepare them for all eventualities, and they will fight well. And the Egyptians and the Syrians and the Iraqi have fought well. You can take any country in this world, however backward it is today, and pour into that country billions of dollars worth of Soviet equipment, and add to that equipment 30,000 Soviet technicians and trainers, captains, generals, lieutenants, and sergeants who will spend 6 years training the troops, participating with them in maneuvers and in war games, drawing up for them the basic battle plan, putting them under simulated war conditions, and you will end up with an effective and efficient modern army. And that's what happened in Egypt and in Syria and in Iraq between 1967 and 1973. While the planners in the Defense Department and the intelligence agencies of the United States and in Israel assumed that they could still fight a war as it had been fought 6 years ago. The Soviets had determined that such a war would not be fought again. And when the war was begun in 1973, Israel lacked the sophisticated equipment with which to counter the more sophisticated equipment which the Egyptians and the Syrians now needed, knew how to use. And that swift control of the sky, which the Israeli Air Force had achieved in 1967, was denied to the Israelis in 1973 because of the new missile equipment and because of the training of those who manned that equipment. And Israel has paid a terrible price in manpower and in equipment for this miscalculation. And the United States is paying a high price in materiel and in cost for this miscalculation. There's no such thing as the art of war. There's only equipment and training and manpower. Put those ingredients together and you'll have an effective army. And obviously the Egypt and Syria and Iraq have put the equipment and the manpower and the training together. Which leads to the basic truth about this war of 1973. In 1967, Israel fought the Arab states. Russia, true, had poured in great numbers of tanks and MiGs and missiles into Egypt and Syria, but really they didn't know how to use them. They were sitting there, but they weren't trained, the troops, in their management. And Israel had a quick victory. But between 1967 and 1973, the Egyptian army essentially became a mercenary army of the Soviet Union. Between 1967 and 1973, the Soviets trained this army, equipped this army, manned this army, provided the sergeants and lieutenants and the captains and the generals for this army, drew up the battle plans for this army, put this army through its simulated maneuvers, and prepared it for the day of battle. And what you had in 1973 was not a struggle between Israel and the Arab states, but a struggle between the Soviet Union and Israel, with the Arab states providing the manpower, the blood, paying the cost of this particular bit of Soviet activity. And we need to understand that this war is essentially a war between the Soviet, through its puppets and its minions, and Israel, and through Israel the West, in order to understand what is really involved. The Soviet Union, I believe, felt that it could gain a rather cheap victory in the Middle East, which would forever solidify its power in the Middle East. Not only would it, in the future, have provided the arms with which Israel had been worn down, for that's certainly the fact on which it gambled, there would be initial success in the Golan, across the canal. America would be neutralized. After all, we were traumatized by Vietnam. We had announced our desire to have an even-handed policy. We were making overtures to the Arab states. We were concerned about oil. They knew that Mr. Nixon wanted to redeem Watergate by some great international accomplishments. And they had tested the will of the United States during the wheat deal and during the salt talks. And they had found a desperation on the part of our government to create an atmosphere of détente, even if we had to pay an excessive price in order to create that atmosphere. They felt that they could neutralize America. America would not respond in any substantial way, for all of these reasons, to Israel's needs, and a slow war of attrition would grind Israel down. Israel would be reduced in size and capacity to respond to a second-rate power. More important, I think, than that, Russia would have driven a wedge between the United States and its client states in the Middle East, the Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, Kuwait, the great oil-rich states. For these will side and with the Arab world, and whatever motions America would have made would have been towards Israel. They would have been too little, but they would have been motions nevertheless. The Arab states would oppose these, and America would have been shown to be that which is the absolute most dangerous image for any great power to have, that of a paper tiger, that of a powerful nation which is unable to use its power and therefore is really powerless. Now, the Soviets gambled that America would not respond to Israel's need. And it set up a beautifully conceived scenario in order to achieve that. Do you remember that during the days immediately preceding the Yom Kippur attack, we were told in our papers that Soviet advisors were leaving from Damascus and they were leaving Cairo? Now, obviously, and our intelligence knew of that, but how did the papers know of it? They knew of it because the Soviet and the Egyptians and the Syrians had allowed them to know this. And they wanted the West to know this. They wanted the West to believe that the Egyptians had attacked despite Russian protestations that they should not have attacked, that the detente would remain firm, that America's concern for this East-West detente would be another one of the shackles which would preclude America from responding energetically and effectively to obvious Israeli needs for materiel. They miscalculated. And that's the great miscalculation of this war. I believe that the Egyptians and the Syrians fully expected to meet an effective Israeli army to be held after some initial success. What neither the Arabs nor the Russians counted on was the unexpected vigor of the American response. Our intelligence was active. And our intelligence knew that the Russians could not put 300 plane loads of boxed missiles and armament into the air, into Damascus and into Syria, the first day of the war, unless they had been prepared before the war, unless they knew of the attack. And our intelligence told us that there were ships, cargo ships at sea, in the Black Sea, moving through the Dardanelles towards Egypt with tanks and planes the day before the war was actually launched. And Mr. Kissinger, the day after the war began, said publicly that no country should act in a mischievous way so as to make the detente which all the world hoped for become something that might not hold, that one might not be able to hold fast. America recognized, and this is to the credit of Mr. Kissinger and our administration, they recognized from the beginning that this was not an Arab-Israel war from which Russia had washed her hands, but this was a mischievous war initiated and sponsored and planned by the Soviet Union, a test of American will, that if America had not responded, great damage would have been done not only to Israel, but to America's positions and ties and relationships all over the world. And so the airlift of American supplies was begun the fourth and fifth days of the war. It took time to get it rolling, and it has continued ever since. The ball, in other words, was tossed back from Washington into Moscow's court. And there it still remains. The world doesn't quite recognize this. I was amused the other day to pick up our Cleveland paper to see the headline, Kosygin in Cairo for Peace Talks. Now, Kosygin wasn't in Cairo for peace talks. Kosygin was in Cairo because the Russian high command in Cairo needed authority on the spot to make a series of new decisions based on a fact they hadn't counted on. America was not a paper tiger. The American claws were real, and Israel would not be worn down the way everyone had expected that she would be worn down, because she was not alone. And now the superpowers began to talk in earnest about their very special interests. And there were conversations in Washington, and Mr. Kissinger is now in Moscow, and obviously there are attempts to create some kind of not only ceasefire, but post-war arrangement for the Middle East. What those arrangements will be, no one yet has the foggiest. So what we have so far is a Russian-sponsored war fought by a Russian-sponsored army, largely for Arab national interests. A war which would have been successful in the long run had not America made the response that she did. A war which may yet be successful in the long run because once the ceasefire is established, once America and Russia agree to the terms in which a detente can continue, the base of support, which is Israel's, becomes small indeed. And there is great danger, of course, that American interests at this point will begin to diverge markedly from Israeli interests. And no one knows what the future will bring. All that we do know is that the ceasefires of 1948, of 1956, of 1967, of 1971 did not bring peace in the area. And any long-term solution, lovely words, but what do they mean? Any long-term solution of the problems of the Middle East will require two things. First, a willingness on the part of Israel to trade land for promises. And that's not a very good trade. Israel has discovered in 1973 how important the empty buffer zones of the Golan and of the Sinai really are to her defense. But Israel never annexed these lands. Israel allowed the world to go on assuming these were Arab lands which could be given back, compromised under certain conditions. And these conditions are, of course, the recognition by the nations of the world that Israel is and that aggression is not to be tolerated again. But the problem is that the Arab world is encouraged that in each one of these successive waves of attack, their base of support has been enlarged. In 1947, the Soviet Union and the United States voted for partition. In 1947 and 48, Israel received arms from the West and from Czechoslovakia and from Russia. In 1956, it was the United States and the Soviet Union which imposed the peace which ended that war. In 1967, the Arab world now reached from Morocco and Algiers to Iraq to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. In 1973, we find North Koreans flying planes in Egypt, North Vietnamese manning the missile stations in Syria. We find the whole third world aligned with the Arab world and the Russian world. And we find the NATO nations of Europe immobilized. France has continued to supply Mirage jets to Libya throughout the conflict. Foreign Minister Michel Joubert went before the Etat General, the French Parliament, 2 days ago to defend this action. Some complain. But he said, we have letters from Libya that say that these weapons will not be used. And that's enough for us. Besides, he said, since when is it aggression for a country to attack a country which is squatting on its own land? Oil, Arab markets, these have clouded la gloire, the French capacity for moral judgment. Even England has withdrawn entirely from the Middle East. Pulled up her skirts, proclaimed neutrality. She won't provide arms to either side, although she is continuing to train Egyptian helicopter pilots in Great Britain. Needing oil, fearing the cutoff of oil, the nations of Western Europe can no longer be counted on, at least for moral support of another democracy. War after war, the Arabs have discovered that the world is willing to gang up with the powerful against the powerless if their special interests are involved. So it's hard to know whether Russia, which is a cause rather than a country, which is an ambition rather than just another greedy nation, whether Russia will truly be willing to impose non-aggression, recognition by Egypt, Syria, etc., of Israel as a nation in the Middle East, or whether what will be imposed is simply another masquerade, another set of words which will have very little substantial reality. And it's very hard to know what American response will be. America is about to be paralyzed by a great constitutional crisis. America has need of oil, not as much need as the papers would have you believe, but America is a fat nation, and fat nations like to remain fat. They don't like to think of driving 50 miles an hour instead of breaking the speed limit. It's hard to know what the long-term American reaction will be, how willing America will be to lean on Israel, to force Israel to accept withdrawal, drawbacks in the name of some fictitious peace. Now, Egypt and Syria and Iraq have nothing to gain by destroying Israel, except some strange nightmare of Arab revenge, fulfillment of that nightmare. It might be possible for these states to accept the existence of Israel. If so, a withdrawal and a drawback would make sense. But will they? There is nothing in the rhetoric of the Arab world which would lead one to believe so. Yes, Mr. Sadat has said, all that we want is the withdrawal of Israel to the 1967 borders, but he's always added, and then we will discuss the rightful claims of the Palestinians. And that's a code phrase. It's a code phrase which means the claims of the Palestinians to all of Palestine, West Bank, and Israel, the toleration by the Palestinians in that country of a small Jewish minority who can prove that they lived there before 1914. The West prefers not to listen to the second stage in Arab rhetoric. We would like to be disembarrassed of a difficult problem. Whatever France and England and the United States are as superpowers, and they are callous and they are greedy, as Vietnam amply proves, whatever they are or are not, there are people of conscience who can express themselves in the West and do express themselves and do unnerve some of the politicians. In the East, there is no debate. When Solzhenitsyn or Sukharov want to express themselves, they are silenced. But in the West, there are men and women of conscience, and there is public debate. And it is not easy for the power brokers in these countries simply to broke power. But there is also oil. There is also economic advantage. And so it's easy to develop a set of pious moralisms which add up to the simple fact that Israel should make it easy for us not to be embarrassed by having to choose between Israel and the Arab world. And that's really what even-handedness is, and that's really what the French position is, and that's really what the English position is. Now, I'm not a prophet. I don't know what's going to happen. So much is happening. Who would have believed that the conditions in Washington today were, you know, what they are today from the news of 3 days ago? And who of us can assess the consequences of that kind of change on this kind of issue? But I would say this to you, that if you believe that once a ceasefire is achieved, and it is clear now that it will be achieved to Israel's advantage, Israel will be at least back to where she was before October 4. If you believe that the danger has passed, when that is achieved, you're a fool. You're a fool in several ways. The Arabs will not be satisfied with it. They planned for 6 years in 67 to undo it. They'll plan again. The Russians will desperately need to prove themselves again to the Arab world, which means more arms, more technicians, more trainers, more equipment. The pipeline of oil will be staunched to a certain degree. There'll be pressures in this country, pressures of all kinds. And the pressures, all these pressures, obviously conspire against Israel. Once a ceasefire begins, our problems begin, really. It's terrible that Israel has lost 1,000 men or more. It's sad to think of the cost in equipment, the cost to our economy, but those things could be absorbed. The question is, can we make that loss, that cost, pay by achieving some kind of security and some kind of peace? And the answer will have to depend upon the courage of the Israeli, how their understanding and their judgment. What guarantees will they accept? Where will they draw the line? Where will they, if necessary, stand up against the world? And how unpopular are we willing to become in order to do what we can to support them? Their judgment, it's their lives, their judgment will have to become, in a sense, our judgment. We cannot tell them what can be given out back and what cannot be given back. It's their young men and their young women who've had to fight to maintain those lines and will have to fight again. We can give some money, we should, and we can give some political support, and we'll have to. But it's not yet clear exactly how that support will have to be directed and what these terms will be. Do I despair? Not at all. You can't be a Jew in despair. Here we are, 4,000 years into Jewish history. The world having conspired against us in the times of Assyria, in the times of Babylon, the times of Persia, the times of Alexander, the times of Rome, the times of the militant Christianity, the times of the Inquisition, the times of the Russian Tsar. There hasn't been a time when the powerful of the world have not conspired against us. Most of them are buried, and we're here. We lost a lot of people along the way. But we didn't lose our humanity. We didn't lose our courage. We didn't lose our faith. Here we are. So I have faith. But don't try and make me prove realistically on what that faith is based. All I can say is that we are going to be tried and we're going to be tested. And this is no time for sunshine soldiers and summer patriots. Amen.